Hello, my friends. So glad you're here with me today. Greg Kokel, your host here on Stand to Reason, and I'm doing something a little different today. Instead of taking calls after some opening comments, as I usually do, I want to focus for this hour just on one issue. And it's an issue that we've talked around quite a bit over the years, but it occurred to me that maybe approaching the issue in an organized way would be helpful to many of you listening, all right? Some of you know that not long ago, I spent almost 2 weeks in Paraguay and did a series of talks in churches and youth groups and also at local universities, including the National University there in Paraguay, speaking in this case to the law school there, which is the largest law school in the country. And I got a chance to speak on the pro-life issue. Now, the reason this is unique, in part, is because I'm at a law school, okay? So these are students that, in the future, are going to have a significant role in having an impact in the lawmaking of that country. Now, Paraguay, at the moment, is still pro-life. It is one of the few countries in the world in which abortion is not yet legal. But there's a lot of pressure from the political left to change that. And that means those who have pro-life convictions, and this is partly due in Paraguay because the large Roman Catholic population, my experience has been that they have not been very effective in making the case. For one, if you want to make the public case regarding abortion, and you're a Christian, so that being pro-life is a reflection in some measure of your Christian convictions, you are not going to be effective making your case from the perspective of your Christian convictions in a secular society. Policy issues that come up that have to do with moral issues might be defended or spoken to based on a scriptural basis. However, if you choose that approach in a kind of a multicultural type society or a secularized society, it just isn't going to make that much difference. And this is why when I spoke to them, I pointed out, notice, after I'd given the presentation, I never quoted the Bible. What I did is I offered you a rationale against abortion and in favor of the value in the life of the unborn from the moment of conception, based completely on scientific, philosophic, and moral considerations. And by the way, even though I say scientific, philosophic, and moral considerations, which is an accurate way of putting it, it doesn't mean that those considerations are difficult, challenging, or out of reach of the average person. I was speaking to a little bit more of a rarefied environment with college professors, law professors, and law students at the university, so more or less graduate level. But I don't speak over the tops of people's heads when I talk about these issues because I want the ordinary folk to get it, the regular crowd to get it. And plus, since my conviction, my intent is not just to tell you what to think, but how to think, to give you tools that will help you to deal with a challenging, in this case, moral issue, to give you a kind of strategy on how to address it. If I speak in language most people can't understand, I'm going to defeat my purpose. So even in what many people would consider a complex question like abortion, what I'm going to want to do is communicate in a very straightforward way, in a way that's accessible to the rank and file, in a way that's organized so it has a strategic thrust that is transferable. That is something that you can pick up on the major points in the way that I go about making this case, and one that does not trade on religious arguments. I could do that. In fact, I've written a solid ground not too long ago where I did that. In fact, I spoke to the issue of abortion from a biblical perspective. but only because I'm writing to Christians there and I'm trying to persuade Christians that the Bible is pro-life and that there is an indisputable argument that I could offer on that behalf. And it's not from the Psalms, it's actually from the Gospels. But that's another issue that can be done. But when we're trying to speak in a public forum on a policy issue, that is not the right strategic approach, I think, particularly in this day and age. 100 years ago, maybe 50 years ago, that would have been helpful, not anymore. So the way I'd like to approach this issue is twofold. I want to address a challenge to the pro-life view that was made by a kind of a popular scientist guy, okay? And read what he said. I think I got this verbatim. I typed out what he said, so I'm quoting here from a video, I believe. Wanted to make sure I got it right. And then I want to respond a little bit to it, because not so that I can find fault in an inappropriate way. I just think that many things that are said here are the kinds of things that are said fairly persistently from the pro-choice side that turn out, ironically, to be very poorly informed scientifically. And I say ironically because this particular individual is a science guy. In fact, his name is Bill Nye, the science guy. And so he's using what he thinks is a scientific argument against the pro-life view. And then he offers additional arguments that have to do with the notion of rights and responsibilities. And then he, curiously, brings the Bible into the discussion in a way that doesn't help him at all. So let me read what he had to say, and then let me respond to a couple of the things that he said. And again, my point here is not to illicitly ridicule, but rather to read a very straightforward criticism of the pro-life position and then talk about some of the things that I think are terribly wrong with this way of arguing. Then, that's the first part, here's a bad argument, a bad set of arguments in favor of the pro-choice view. And by the way, I'm not just singling out bad ones, like, oh, I'm going to find the most ludicrous characterization I can and then make it look silly. What you're going to hear there here are the kinds of things you hear on a regular basis from all sorts of people. So this is a standard on the street, as it were, kind of challenge to the pro-life position. And then I'm going to give you a strategy to counter it, to make our case. All right. So this is from Bill Nye, N-Y-E, the science guy. He's got a TV program, apparently, and has made a bit of a name for himself doing popular science so people could have access to basic scientific information. I don't know what group he deals with principally, if it's high school or grade school or whatever. I remember when I was in school, there was a guy kind of like that, a science guy that we watched these films. They weren't videos then. They were, you know, on a reel when I was a kid. And he was the science guy, you know, and he'd explain somewhat complex things in ways that we could understand it. So nothing wrong with this at all. But here's what he said. And remember, I'm quoting here. Many, 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 many more hundreds of eggs are fertilized than become humans. Eggs get fertilized, and by that I mean sperm get accepted by ova a lot. But that's not all you need. Now, I think what he means here is you got fertilized eggs, but that doesn't mean they're human. You need something more, okay? So I'm continuing. You have to attach to the uterine wall, the inside of a womb, a woman's womb. But if you're going to hold that as a standard, and I guess he means as a standard for valuable humanity, and therefore you can't abort at that point. That is to say, if you're going to say when an egg is fertilized, it's therefore has the same rights as an individual, then whom are you going to sue? Whom are you going to imprison? Every woman who's had a fertilized egg pass through her? Every guy whose sperm has fertilized an egg and then it didn't become a human? Have all of these people failed you? It's just a reflection of a deep scientific lack of understanding, and you literally, or apparently literally, don't know what you're talking about. Okay, so that's the first part of his statement. I'm just pausing. It's, you know, I've read this a number of times, and each time I read it, I'm so surprised at what I read. Because the conclusion here is that people who are pro-life don't know what they're talking about scientifically because they have a scientific lack of understanding. But listen to how, again, how he starts. Many, many, many more hundreds of eggs are fertilized than become humans. In other words, what he's saying is that a fertilized egg is not a human. What is it? Is my question. And my question is not what is it morally. My question is what is it scientifically? And so I went to Sadler and Langman's Medical Embryology 7th edition and standard textbook, medical textbook on the issue of embryology. And here's what it says. Quote, the development of a human begins with fertilization, a process by which the spermatozoan from the male and the oocyte from the female unite to give rise to a new organism, the zygote. Close quote. Now, let me be clear. This is not scientifically controversial. So in Bill Nye's The Science Guy's opening criticism of the pro-life view, he makes an observation that he thinks is significant, that hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of eggs are fertilized that do not become human. And then he chastises pro-lifers for thinking that they do, and because of that, it's an example of a lack of scientific understanding, and you, quote, literally or apparently literally don't know what you're talking about. Here's my observation. Bill Nye, the science guy, does not know what he's talking about. Okay, with regards to the fertilization question, a fertilized egg is a human being. That is standard science. Not making a case for or again abortion here. I'm just making this clear. All right. But then he makes another statement that is a bit confusing. And the statement has to do with, what are you going to do then with all of these fertilized eggs that you pro-lifers think are human but isn't? If they die, who are you going to sue? Who are you going to imprison? Every woman who's had a fertilized egg pass through her? Of course, this is not on the table for pro-lifers. No one ever says that somebody ought to pay if there is a miscarriage at the earliest stages of pregnancy. Of course, there are lots of those. Why does he bring this up? It has nothing whatever to do with the pro-life view. Okay? So far, he's made a scientific mistake, and then he's struck out at something that is utterly irrelevant to the moral question that we're concerned with. So I'm going to continue reading. Quote, and so when it comes to women's right with respect to their reproduction, I think you should leave it to women. This is really, you cannot help but notice, I'm not the first guy to observe this. You have a lot of men of European descent passing these extraordinary laws based on ignorance. Sorry, you guys, I know it was written, or your interpretation of a book written 5,000 years ago, 50 centuries ago, makes you think that when a man and a woman have sexual intercourse, they always have a baby. That's wrong, and so to pass laws based on that belief is inconsistent with nature. Close quote. Now, he makes one claim here that with respect to reproduction, you should leave the decision to a woman. All right. Well, there's a certain sense when a lot of pro-lifers might be comfortable with that when it comes to reproduction. The question, though, is whether reproduction has already happened when a woman is pregnant. And according to embryology, it has. That was why I read you that citation from the embryology book. So that moment is past, Bill Nye. Then this is a canard that's often brought up, that there are lots of European guys, a lot of men of European descent, passing extraordinary laws based on ignorance. Okay, I'm not. It still isn't clear what ignorance that he thinks is in play here, but just want to make a couple of observations. I've already shown that Nye's own view is based on embryological ignorance. Secondly, Nye, as far as I can tell, is a man of European descent who's weighing in on this issue. Now, I'm not trying to be a smarty pants here. I know he's a guy. I'm just not sure about his European descent. But does that matter? All of the Supreme Court justices that decided on Roe versus Wade, that made abortion legal essentially through all stages of gestation, were men. Arguments don't have genders, friends. The same arguments that men offer could be offered by women as well. So here is an attempt to undermine the force of an argument on the pro-life side in a completely illicit way. What does it matter if they're European men? An issue stands or falls on its merits, okay? The discussion here is about whether or not it's right to take the life of an innocent human being. That a person who is arguing it's not right is a male is completely irrelevant to the legitimacy of the charge, or the claim, rather, the argument itself. And here's a parallel, just if you want to think about this. What if I said, you know, when it comes to slavery, you should leave the question up to the slave owner. After all, the slave is his property, right? Instead, now you have a situation where a lot of non-slave owners are trying to dictate to slave owners what rights they have over their own property. Now, I know people are going to push back at this attempt at parallel, but why is it not parallel? The arguments of the abolitionists were that it doesn't matter whether you're a slave owner or not. The issue has nothing to do with interests. It has to do with whether or not a black human being is a valuable human being and should be protected under the law, whether they should be enslaved or not. Same circumstance here. The question, the enslaved human beings or property, is precisely the thing that's at issue there, and it's the same thing we're facing here. The question of whether a woman has a right to do whatever she wants with the human being growing inside of her is precisely the issue here. So Nye's point is an exercise in circular reasoning. So I'll just read his final paragraph, which is more of the same. I mean, it's hard not to get frustrated with this, everybody. And I agree with him at that point. And I know nobody likes abortion, okay? But you can't tell somebody what to do. I mean, she has rights over this, especially if she doesn't like the guy that got her pregnant. She doesn't want anything to do with your genes. Get over it, especially if she were raped and all this. We have so many more important things to be dealing with. We have so many more problems to squander resources on this argument based on bad science or just lack of understanding. Close quote. Okay. The only bad science, that's been exemplified here is Bill Nye's Bad Science. The only lack of understanding that has been exemplified here is Bill Nye's lack of understanding. He says you can't tell somebody what to do. First of all, isn't he telling us what to do? Don't tell other people what to do? Don't tell a woman what she can do with her own body? So his general approach commits suicide. But the fact is, you can tell people what to do. That's what the law is for. The whole point of the law is to tell people what they can and can't do with their own body when higher moral considerations than individual autonomy are in play. Anyway, so these are, he did mention the Bible indirectly. I know it was written, or your interpretation of a book written 5,000 years ago, 50 centuries ago, makes you think that when a man or a woman have sexual intercourse, they always have a baby. Who believes that? Who believes that when a man and woman have sexual intercourse, they always have a baby? Nobody does. And by the way, he got the date wrong for the Bible, obviously. It wasn't written 5,000 years ago. Some portions were 4,000, some 2,000, etc. Never mind, I'm not going to fuss about that so much. But our arguments are not based on the Bible, especially what he claimed, that the Bible teaches that whenever you have intercourse, you have a baby. Really? And by the way, even if they were, just because the book is old doesn't mean its ideas are false. Basically, you have to address the ideas proper and not dismiss them due to age. Incidentally, much of science is guided by Aristotle's laws of logic, and those go back 2,500 years. Okay, so here's an example of how not to argue the issue of abortion. All that is scientific misunderstanding and specious appeals to fallacies like straw man fallacy, genetic fallacy, both in play here by Bill Nye, the science guy. With that aside, let's talk about how a better way to argue about this issue. And I think the better way is the arguments in support of protecting the life of the unborn human being that is growing inside of the womb of the mother. Now notice, I've kind of made some claims there. The human being growing inside of the womb of the mother. But of course, by embryology, we know there is a human being inside there, and that it's a separate being from the mother. Incidentally, we're all familiar with CSI now, watching TV, and the whole genetic deal. We know that the thing that is growing, that is inside mom, is alive. People say, hey, nobody knows when life begins. Okay, yes, we do. Embryology makes it clear. This is not controversial. But here's a simple way to get there, is a question. Is it growing? Yes, that's the problem, right? If it's growing, then it's alive. There you go. Simple as that. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here. I mentioned CSI, and you can do the DNA analysis and find out the DNA shows that it's a human being. But let's hold off for a moment, because there's a different... When I talk with somebody about this issue, I don't just jump right into all of these things. I ask them a question first to set the stage. What I'm trying to demonstrate is that there's really only one thing that we need to decide or determine in order for us to know whether or not abortion is right or wrong. So this is a move here to simplify the issue. And I was listening, by the way, to a debate a number of years ago between Scott Klusendorf, who at that time was director of bioethics for us at Stand to Reason. He now has his own organization for many years now, Life Training Institute out of Atlanta. And but he was debating with Anna Runkle, who was with Planned Parenthood. And in calm, even tones, she was making her case. And she was saying, well, abortion is a decision between a woman, her doctor, and her God. And making abortion illegal is going to force women into dangerous back alley abortions. And after all, women should have a right to choose. And who are we to judge when women labor so hard over these tough decisions? So these are kind of standard statements that were made. But I was thinking to myself, you know, actually, you have a point that we shouldn't interfere between a woman or doctor and her God. We shouldn't force women into dangerous back alley abortions. We shouldn't take away a woman's right to choose or judge the difficult decision that she's making if. Now, this is a big if. If what? And that answer depends upon the answer to another question. So I want to lead up to that question with an illustration. And as I was saying, this particular illustration is usually the first point I make in a conversation with someone about abortion. So you may want to use the illustration yourself. It's a powerful way to simplify the issue that some people mistakenly think is complex. Here it is. I want you to imagine yourself working in your home somewhere. Maybe you're at a workbench, or you're at your computer, or you're fixing some food, or you're cleaning the dishes up, or whatever. In your back is you're facing your project, and your child comes up to you behind your back and asks a question. So your back is turned to them, and the question is, "Daddy, Mommy, can I kill this? Can I kill this?" Now, remember, your back is to them. So what is the first question you must have answered before you can answer the question, "Can I kill this?" Well, the question is, what is it? If it's a spider, smash it. Don't tell your mom. If it's a kitten that your sister owns, wait, slow down. If it's your sister, sit down. We have to take a break here and talk about it a little bit. Now, this simple illustration teaches something very foundational and basic and non-controversial. And that is, before you know it's right or wrong to kill any living thing, you first have to know what that thing is. What is it? So, when it comes to the unborn, that's the question. So, Anna Runkle, you're entirely right. If the unborn is not a human being, the same way that you and I are human, then no problem. Actually, let me put it this way. If the unborn is not a human being, then no justification for abortion is necessary. Do what you want. You don't have to talk about choice and privacy and, you know, a woman and her doctor and her God and all that other stuff. If what you want to do is remove a piece of tissue that is not a human being, why do you need anybody's permission to do that? You don't need that for any other piece of tissue in your body. Just have the abortion. You don't even have to have this discussion at all. However, if the unborn is a human being, then no justification for abortion is adequate, because we do not kill defenseless human beings for the reasons most people have abortions, because they have a right to privacy or choice, or because they're too expensive. That would be the baby, the child. Having another kid is too expensive because they just don't want more kids for whatever reason. Or, by the way, even because they remind us of a terribly traumatic event like a rape. That is not an adequate reason to kill our 4-year-old, our 2-year-old, our 1-year-old. None of those are. Okay? So what this does, I think, is given the claim that when it comes to abortion, this is complex, this is hard, there are no easy answers. Well, if I'm right on this, then the abortion question is not complex at all. That is, all we need to do is answer one simple question. What is the unborn? And then we know what our answer is to the moral question of abortion. Now, is it difficult to apply what we learn to be right? Of course it is. This is always the case. Sometimes coming to proper moral conclusions is not hard. Implementing the proper moral conclusions is really hard. That's the way life often is. So what I've done so far is I've tried to simplify the issue. And that is, we ask the question, what is the unborn? And if the unborn's not a human being, no justification for abortion is necessary. If it is a human being, no justification for abortion is adequate. Okay? So now I'm going to give you, and there may be some objections kind of lingering or in the wings here, so let me take another step with this. I want to give you what I'm going to call the moral logic of the pro-life view. And I'm actually amazed at how many pro-lifers are not able to articulate what I'm about to offer you. And it's not difficult. It's not complicated, but it does organize the ideas in a very fruitful and productive way. Because it has to do with, why is abortion wrong? If we're trying to outlaw it in some sense, it's only because we think it's a great evil or a great harm and shouldn't be done. But why is it a harm? That's the question. The moral logic of the pro-life view answers that question, and here it is. It's the form of a syllogism. That's an argument. We have a couple of premises and a conclusion that follows from the premise. That may sound tricky. When you hear it, you'll see it's not. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. There's a syllogism. Very simple, very straightforward, uncomplicated, unadorned. That's the way you like it. That's the way you want it, to think carefully about critical moral issues. So here is the syllogism. First premise: it's wrong to take the life of an innocent human being. Okay, so that's our start. That's a moral premise, by the way. In other words, it's a moral claim. We're saying that some behavior is wrong. But it's not a controversial claim. Second premise: abortion takes the life of an innocent human being. Therefore, now you can figure it out from here. If it's wrong to take the life of an innocent human being, and abortion does that, then abortion is what? Abortion is wrong. So there's the moral logic. And by the way, that is a valid argument. In other words, if each of the sentences, the first two premises, are true, the conclusion follows of necessity, which makes it a very powerful way to argue. And that's why we use it. We have simplified the issue, and then we have offered an argument. Now, the question is whether the argument stands. We know the argument follows if the first two premises are true. Are they? Well, the first premise is not controversial, as I pointed out. What about the second premise, that abortion takes the life of an innocent human being? Well, this isn't controversial either when you think about it. Now, I'm going back to some earlier statements and to Bill Nye's confusion about embryology, even though he's the science guy. As we learn from the embryology book and common sense dictates, the individual human being starts at conception. You want to do family planning? Well, I'm not opposed to it. Once you conceive, family planning opportunities are over with. You know why? Because now you have a child. I should say, now you have an innocent human being. Where is it? It's inside mom, right where that innocent human being is supposed to be, right where he or she belongs, growing there, having been created by mom and dad. That's the natural way. It's the way it's done. So there's nothing surprising here, but the question then is, well, can I kill this? And my question is, well, what is it? Well, we know it's a human being. from embryology. No, it's the woman's body. Well, it's in the woman's body. There's no question that the woman's body is involved, just the way a mom's body is involved with a six-month-old or a two-month-old or a one-day-old. Ladies, you know, you have a baby, and that baby is yours for a long, long time, and you are imprisoned by that child. So your body is taken over even after the child is born and for a long time. You understand my point. And we also know that body in there is, I mean, from science, we know that it's a human being because the DNA is separate from the mother's DNA. It has a different fingerprint. It's unique, but it has a human signature. That what kind of DNA is that? Well, that's human DNA. Well, where does human DNA come from? Human beings. So now I'm throwing some science around, especially for the Bill Nye crowd, but you don't need to do that because every mother knows this. I'm looking through the glass here at a mother who is now the mother of two, but one hasn't made his debut yet, okay? Now, I guarantee you, Brooke is not wondering, what's it going to be? Wonder what it's... When your cat is in the feline family way, let's put it that way, are you wondering what's going to come out when birth happens? No, cats have kittens, right? Dogs have puppies, okay? What do human beings have? So a woman has seven kids, right? She's pregnant again. Is she wondering, gee, I wonder what's going to be this time? She gives birth to another child. Oh, my goodness, eight in a row. What are the chances? No. Human beings produce other human beings. There is no ambiguity about this. There's no confusion about this. When a woman is pregnant, she is carrying a separate individual human being, her offspring. She reproduces after her own kind. Well, it doesn't look like a human being. Of course it does. It looks like every human being looks like at that stage of development, whether it's one cell or dozens of cells or whether it's a fetus or whether it's a newborn or whether it's a toddler or whether it's a teenager, whether it's an adult, whether it's a human being. These are all different stages of the development of the same human being. So human beings change what they look like over time. They do not change what they are. And this is really critical. All of the talk that people do to distract you cannot change the very simple, my apologies to Bill Nye, scientific facts that when a woman is pregnant, even at the very first stage, she carries a unique human being. And abortion kills that human being, whether that abortion happens while the human being is still moving down the fallopian tube and has not yet attached or has attached. In either case, wherever it's located, it's still what it is. And what it is a human being. And whether it's RU486 or a saline abortion or a DNC or any of these other means by which people take the life, I should say, abort the child, in all of those cases, they are taking the life of an innocent human being. So back now to our basic argument. Very simple. It's wrong to kill an innocent human being. Abortion does that, kills an innocent human being, therefore abortion is wrong. That's called not just a valid argument, but a sound argument. Now, this is a point where some folk want to make a move to avoid or evade the force of the argument. They want to say, well, all right, we're with you that it's a human being. We can't get away from that scientifically. The genes, the embryology, reproducing after their own kind, all of that stuff makes it obvious. You don't need to be a scientist to know this. However, Maybe we were a little too hasty with that first premise. Maybe it's not always wrong to kill an innocent human being. Maybe it's only wrong to kill an innocent human person. Okay? That is the move of choice at this particular point. Okay? And so this is where a lot of people are going to go. Maybe some human beings are not human persons. That's the move. Very popular now. The conventional wisdom. It's the kind of thing that seems to come out of everybody's mouth nowadays. Fine. I understand the maneuver. And hopefully you see that too. It's an attempt to avoid the force of the first premise. But there's a very important question that needs to be asked at this point, because what they have just asserted is that there are some human beings that are not human persons. All right, I get it. What's the difference is the question. What is the difference? Meaning, what distinguishes a human being who is not a person from a human being who is a person? Now, that's a question that the person who offers this rejoinder has got to answer. And I'll tell you why. Because they have just divided humanity into two groups. And when I was making this point with the law students and professors there at the National University in Uganda, Asuncion, Uganda, it was really convenient because there was a big center aisle with seats on either side. And there was my dividing point. You divided humanity into two groups, human persons and human non-persons. And human persons get full protection of the law. You kill a human person and you're in big trouble with the law. But on the other side, human non-persons, you can kill with impunity. Without any reason at all, except for that you want it. And in some cases, the government will even help you to do that. So, if you have humanity divided into two groups, one group gets full protection and the other group can be killed with impunity and the full protection of the law in so doing, you better be really clear where that line actually is. What side of the line are you on? Are you on the human person side or the human non-person side? Well, obviously, I'm on the human person side. Oh, what is it that makes you a human person and the unborn a human non-person? That's what I'm asking for. What is the criterion? And, of course, people have come up with lists. Where do they get the lists? Who gets to say which list of qualifications that make a human being a protectable person gets the go-ahead? You have your list. Maybe I have my list. What if on my list I said, okay, human persons and human non-persons are distinguished between whether they're gay or not? Why not? Now, that's not my view. But why not? If you can make up your list and say, well, they have a future, they have conscious, they make conscious choices, they whatever. There's all kinds of things that philosophers and individuals have made up, and these lists don't match. They're different lists. So some would count some as persons and others as non-persons. According to what? Why not just say black slaves are non-persons? Guess what? We did that for a long time. Here in the United States of America, and many other places too. Why not say that Jews are non-persons, or that mentally handicapped or mentally retarded children, or those born with congenital defect, or gypsies, or homosexuals are non-persons? That's what the Third Reich decided. Why not that line? That's what you're going to do. Do you see my point here? This move of distinguishing between human persons and human non-persons has a history, and it's not a very noble history. Okay? here's what I think this personhood maneuver amounts to. What the personhood maneuver, that a standard maneuver in play nowadays, amounts to is just legal double talk. It's legal ledger domain. It's slate of hand that has one purpose, and that is to take bona fide members of the human family and disqualify them as bona fide members of the human community. Oh, you might be human. Too bad. That's not enough. We don't want you in our community because there is something you're missing, or something we don't like, or something we're not going to accept. So you're not an example of a valuable human being. I have mentioned this before, but do you know that in the country of Iceland, they have proudly announced that they virtually eliminated Down syndrome? Wow, really? How'd you do that? By killing every child who has Down syndrome, with the qualification that the killing is done in the womb and not outside of the womb. So in the entire country of Iceland, you might have one or two or three or four a year slip by the amniocentesis, the search and destroy effort, and they are born. But most they're able to get before they get out of the womb, and they kill them inside the womb. Why? Because these are not considered persons under the law because of their defect and because of their location. They are defective because they have Down syndrome, and they are not located in a place where the Down syndrome child would be protected. That would be outside of the womb. They're inside of the womb, and so it's open season on them. So what has happened here? There's a line that's been drawn that describes what a legitimate human person is, and it does not include Down syndrome babies. And it's not just Down syndrome, it's just a dramatic example. This kind of thing is happening all over the world and in this country as well for all kinds of different things, not just Down syndrome. And by the way, those of you moms who were pregnant and had an amniocentesis and your doctor determined that your child had Down syndrome or something like it, you know the pressure that was put on you to destroy that child because the child wasn't perfect. So this is what we've become. This is what it's come to in the United States of America. It's come to the point where we have divided up human beings into a protected group and a disposable group. Now, what this means then is that humans do not have intrinsic value. That is, there is no value that humans possess in virtue of being human. Now, the Declaration of Independence trades on a different notion. It says that we have been endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Why are they inalienable? It's because the Creator has made human beings in a certain way, and that just being human is all you need to have these rights. That was their logic. Okay, well, people are saying, no, it's not just being human. You got to be a human person. Okay, now you've changed the logic, just to be clear. Now you've changed the logic to humans not having rights intrinsically, but they eventually gain rights extrinsically. These are not intrinsic values. These are instrumental values. And what I mean is that they are value. It's value that's added to the human later in virtue of something the human can do. Some instrumental value that accrues to them in virtue of something that gets added later. Okay, now think about this. On this view, then, human beings don't have value in themselves, only human beings that can do the valuable making thing. Okay, now that has application for the front end of life. This is what we're talking about, but it also has application for the back end of life. If what makes you valuable as a human being is the thing that you do, the capability that you have, the added extrinsic thing that you possess sometime after you're born, what happens later down the line, 60, 70, 80 years later, when that particular thing that gave you value early on now is gone? Then you have no value. This is the problem with instrumental or intrinsic value. Once you lose that thing, then you lose that value. As opposed to the view that humans, qua human, that is, in virtue of being a mere human being, has intrinsic value, regardless of where they're located or what they can do or what they look like. If you're human, that you got it. Inalienably, you've got it because it's built in deeply to you. And incidentally, there's a spinoff on this, and I'm already laid the argument proper down. I'll review it in a moment, but I'm just showing you how this other maneuver works. The personhood maneuver. The personhood maneuver that has been used to annihilate millions and millions and millions of defenseless human beings. And I don't mean just abortion. I mean ethnic cleansing. I mean the Third Reich, the master race. I mean slavery. All of those things trade on the same essential notion. Here's the other thing, is if the thing that makes a human valuable is some extrinsic feature, then if some non-human thing has that same extrinsic feature that creates value, then they get the same value. And this is why people like Peter Singer, ethicist from Yale, has argued that some higher primates, chimpanzees, bonobos, orangutan, gorillas, have more rights than a newborn child because they possess these capabilities that give them extrinsic value. You see where this is going. What's he doing? He's following the logic of his point of view. It's that simple. And that is the logic of the point of view. And that's why we have to lay out the foundational logic of our point of view to contrast it with their point of view, which leads to these bizarre and obviously immoral consequences. Now, there's more that could be said about this. There are actually four categories of things that people use in their lists to disqualify some human beings from being human persons. Stephen Schwarz has developed this list. It's magnificent. It's in its simplicity. It's called the SLED test, S-L-E-D. Size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency. Size or appearance, okay? Level of development, that would be abilities. Environment, where you are, inside the womb or outside the womb. Degree of dependency, whether the unborn is able to survive outside of the womb. I'm not going to go into all of those here. I don't have time to, but that would just make our arguments more precise if we wanted to do it. The point I'm making is in each one of these examples, if you accept either the size, level of development, environment, or degree of dependency as a legitimate reason to disqualify the human personhood and value of a human being in the womb, you are going to also, by the same standard, disqualify the value of some other human being walking around the world. And their life is going to be forfeit too by the same standard. So what I've offered here is first some examples of bad ways to argue against the pro-life view. And those, even though coming from an intelligent and educated guy, are uneducated and unintelligent challenges. And I think it was obvious in what I read. Certainly the science. And then I offered a way of arguing for the pro-life view. I called it I simplified the issue, asking the question, what is it? And that needs to be answered. And if the unborn isn't a human being, then no justification for abortion is necessary. But if it is a human being, then no justification for abortion is adequate. Okay? And then I laid out the moral logic of the pro-life view. And that is, it's wrong to take the life of an innocent human being. Abortion takes the life of an innocent human being. Therefore, abortion is wrong. The first premise seemed obvious. The second one was in question until we look at the science, and that becomes obvious. Now, the conclusion then follows, but people don't want that, so they're going to take exception with the first premise. Well, it's not human beings that are valuable, but human persons. And so I taught you to ask the question, what's the difference? Where is that dividing line? And you got to know that. There's a list. How'd you make up the list? Why can't I make up my own list? And this move, as I pointed out, has a very ugly history. Hasn't worked. Innocents died by the millions as a result of this move, and they are still dying by the millions as a result of this move. And that, my friends, is the best that I can do to sum up in a fairly brief amount of time why the pro-life view is the morally, not just superior view, but the only moral view on the abortion question. Hope what I've said is helpful to you. I'm Greg Kokel. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye, friends.